And welcome to Talk of the Rock. I'm your host, Jared Griffin. A couple of months ago, I had on this show representatives of Kodiak Teen Court, and we had a good conversation about juvenile justice and the juvenile justice system in Alaska. But we were only able to scratch the surface of this important issue that affects thousands of children and teenagers and their families across the United States. And I was inspired by that conversation with Kodiak Teen Court and reached out to today's guest, Regina Griego. Now, Regina is not a resident of Kodiak, but we won't hold that against her. Regina has enjoyed a distinguished career as an engineer, holding a PhD, Master's of Science, and Bachelor's of Science in Electrical and Computer Engineering, and a Master's in Computer Science. But now Regina is a coach, author, and speaker about gun safety and juvenile justice. Regina's from New Mexico. Her Hispanic roots go back 400 years, and she's mentored many people as a professor, senior engineer, and leadership coach. And she published an award-winning book last year called Sins of the System, Trauma, Guns, Tragedy, and the Betrayal of Our Children. And you can check out that book and her website and other resources on transcendingfutures.com. Sorry, we're just having just a little bit of technical difficulties. Regina, are you there?
I am.
All right. Welcome, Regina.
Hi, Jared.
We've had ice storms, wind storms, all sorts of things are messing up the radio here. But you're in New Mexico, and I'm sure it's a lovely, lovely winter day in the Sandia Mountains.
Sunshine. A little chilly, but it's nice.
So you started out you had an illustrious career as an electrical and computer engineer. What started this new pathway down being an advocate for gun safety and juvenile justice?
Well, in January 2013, my 15-year-old nephew shot and killed my brother, his father, his mother, and three of his siblings. And in the aftermath of that, it took me a little while because we were in the courts and stuff. But in 2018, I started to engage both in the Coalition for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, because after realizing what my nephew had gone through and suffering, he suffered also a mental break, I felt like the court system needed to deal with him as a juvenile and as somebody with mental health issues. And then also gun sense and gun safety, which I do that through everytown for gun safety. And we have the grassroots organization is called Moms Demand Action. And I'm a survivor membership lead here in New Mexico. And that we advocate basically for laws that limit access to people who should not have them, including children and people with mental health issues.
And that's kind of what your book is about, Sins of the System. It's a memoir of your experience working through the justice system with your nephew.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The 7-year journey. We went through two rounds of it after an appeal came through against him, and initially he was going to get out at age 21. And that was one of the difficulties of the whole process, is that he gets out at age 21 if he's treated as a juvenile and he's deemed amenable, which just means he's salvageable, or they give life. And that's what he ultimately got, was a life sentence. Hmm. Plus 7 years.
Life plus 7 years. Wow.
Yeah.
So what can you talk more about the challenges and issues within the juvenile justice system that you had to work through with your nephew, and how that's kind of affected your work today?
Well, he was sent first to a youth detention center, and they're not interested in giving him any kind of help in terms of mental health. They're mostly worried about keeping him from harming himself or harming other people, so they don't really delve into some of his mental health issues. So I advocated to get him into an adolescent treatment center, and that was a process. But as a result of that, we learned that when he was first tested educationally, because they hadn't done much work with him either educationally, and he was a 15-year-old operating with a 13-year-old brain, and he was tested as a third grader in most of the areas of study when he was 17 years old, and because his parents supposedly were homeschooling him, but they did not do that. And he stayed, and he in 19 months, he jumped four grades as a result of his work at the Adolescent Treatment Center, and they put him in intensive therapy. So that was something that we had to, you know, actively advocate for. Most people or kids will just go to this detention center, which is just a holding pen for these kids, and they don't get their needs met. And then the court system, as I said, you have to, he ultimately plead, and the plea he made allowed him to be in the juvenile system. And that's when, with all the progress he had made, the children's court judge deemed that he was amenable to treatment, which meant he was salvageable. But just before he was going to get out, there was an appeal. And it was interesting because it was almost like the immune system of the DAs in the state of New Mexico that came at him. And, you know, the book goes into how, you know, we had a cabinet secretary showing up at his meetings before he was going to be released. And, of course, later on we saw her with her counsel interacting with the prosecution in the second round after the appeal came through for the state. And so there's a natural tendency that once somebody is found or pleased, that they want to send them to prison instead of working with these young people. And like I said, he had a traumatic brain injury from being knocked down by his father at least once. And he also suffered from hallucinations, both audio and visual hallucinations. And that was one of the things that was happening that night, is that he was listening to what they called a command hallucination, telling him he had to complete the mission and he was, a pussy and all that kind of stuff if he didn't. And anyway, the juvenile system doesn't treat children as children. And they only go through 20. And so that's what happened finally, ultimately, is that because he was 21, there was no services allowed for him beyond 21. So the only option was to put him in adult prison. And because the risk assessment they did said that if he goes to prison, he needs to stay there, because prison will only, you know, erode the work that they had done. And that's what they did. They gave him 30 years plus 7 years. And after that, I became very active on a bill that we called the Second Chances Bill, which allows juveniles, people that have committed crimes as juveniles that land in adult prison, the opportunity after 15 years to go before a parole board. And it's just a chance. They have to have proved, because the brain develops for young people very, very fast. Mm-hmm. And to throw a child away is just a criminal in my mind. I think they should have juvenile systems till they're age 25, when their brain stops developing. And this other bill that we passed, the Second Chances, I think should be throughout the nation to prove that they're safe outside. And then he'll get every 5 years another opportunity. Whereas before, he would have been 53 before he got the first shot at parole, which is, you know, like I say, criminal. You're throwing a kid that was raised poorly away, basically.
I want to get back to the legislation and policy stuff you're working on. But before that, it seems like with my other discussions and interviews with people involved in the juvenile justice system, the common misconception people have about juvenile offenders is that they just made the wrong choice. They just made the bad choice. And but it seems like there's almost always a bigger, deeper underlying conditions that the system just is not equipped to support.
absolutely. I don't know if you're familiar with ACEs, Adverse Childhood. I forget the entire acronym, but basically there's different elements that they evaluate to see how much adverse situations, like, you know, drugs in the home, mm-hmm. or poverty or learning difficulties or various things like that. And almost all children that are in the YDDC, the Youth Detention Center, have at least 8 of those area going against them. So there's usually multiple factors that these kids have against them that leads to situations, poor situations that they get themselves into, and poor judgment. And children do not think long-term. They just don't. And they're very, very susceptible to peer pressure. And they can be used by other people, you know?
Right. Oh, for sure. So let's get into some other legislative policy initiatives related to juvenile justice that you're working on. What are some of the ones right now that you're like specifically supporting or advocating for? You mentioned the Second Chances Bill.
Yeah, that's the big one, and we just passed this last legislative system. We did that after 4 or 5 years of trying to get it passed, and then I'm trying to do that in other states. I just went to a policy seminar in Arizona, which has nothing for juveniles. And then we're also working not on the legislative side, but on the support side. So there's a nonprofit called Deserving Life. That is going to now get into how we're going to support these young people that are now going through earlier parole hearings and whatnot. So how to transition them. And in that process, there will probably be some legislative kinds of at least funding issues that we'll have to address, and support issues that we'll address. So on the juvenile side, it's more about what to support these people that are going to potentially get out earlier than they thought. And it's crazy because they, in New Mexico, and I imagine this happens in other states, kind of lose track of their juvenile offenders that have gone to prisons, especially like my nephew has been farmed out to North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them that they just lose track of. They're just, you know, the state is just paying these other prison systems to take care of them. And they're very, very poor prison systems. So we need to support them if they are able to get out.
Mm-hmm. What's kind of in your vision for a more effective juvenile justice system? Like, what kind of role do you see rehabilitation and education playing?
Well, certainly the educational element of the detention center needs to improve, and as I said, and also the mental health, in making the mental health assessment and having police officers and other individuals that are, you know, that basically surround this child more trauma aware, because a lot of these police officers, I mean, they held my nephew after he hadn't slept for 48 hours, they held him for 3 hours, 2 officers, and they supposedly Mirandized him. But this kid hadn't slept for 2 days, and he was clearly in a mental health. So they need to help support these young people when they get arrested with some advocate on the spot, child advocate on the spot. And then there's, of course, the detention center and how much support they get. And then I strongly, strongly believe, like I said earlier, that there should be youth services till age 25. Because in these cases, like my nephew, which are kind of extreme, I mean, his case was extreme, he needed more time. And the judge actually said that. If I had some place to send him as a juvenile until he was age 25, I would do that. But since there's nothing that exists, I have to send him to adult prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so these children should not be put in prison until their brain is fully developed and they've had services in the area of mental health and educational services and transition services, transitioning them to society. And what that looks like, and they have them, you know, for till age 21, is the person, the young man person, stays at a facility, but he's able to get a job in the outside and keeps coming back to that facility. And it's last, and they, in his trial, they said this needs to be at least 6 months worth of transition process so that you know that they can safely, what they call life skills were lacking.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't have, because his dad was very isolated to his kids very much. And so he didn't have basic life skills like how to catch a bus or, you know, how to make change.
Mm-hmm.
Simple things like that he did not understand. So those are the three elements I think are
okay.
Need to be there.
So you kind of were getting into some of the science, you know, brain science, and you kind of come from not a biological scientific field, but from a science of engineering field. How did you? What are some of the things that you brought from your experience as a teacher, as a professor, as a computer and electrical engineer? Is there anything that kind of translated over to your skills as an advocate in these arenas?
Oh yes, I am a fellow of the professional society called the International Council on Systems Engineering, and in 2018 we did a whole analysis of what's a system and the different various kinds of systems, including social systems. And so when I was looking through this, the juvenile justice system is a system. The family is a system. So I looked at this whole thing from that system lens. And that's why the book is called Sins of the System, because there's a lot of systems that fail families and in particular fail children. And that's what we got to look at. We got to look at, for instance, the homeschooling system in New Mexico. I have nothing against homeschooling. It's just that if a child is homeschooled, there should be some accountability for the fact that this child is learning and progressing in his studies. And that doesn't exist in New Mexico. You just have to register and say you're going to homeschool your child, and there is no follow-up. And that's criminal, because you don't know what's going to come of this child once they leave that home. And also, it's also a hotbed for potential for abuse.
Oh, for sure.
And so I look through the lens of systems in this whole thing, and you know, just the kind of very basic kinds of things like how they allow interaction with the family. It's a very hostile environment for go visit these people that are, you know, in detention centers. The best one was the adolescent treatment center, but the other ones, they don't have good interfaces. You know, they're like at the detention center, like once a week, and you have to have a particular time, and the same thing with the one that he was in after he had originally gone through the first set of hearings. And it's just the children, they're children after all, and they were very guarded about even giving a hug to the child or anything like that. And I just felt like it was hostile to the family who tries to get involved. It's limiting. And then, of course, when he went to the jail while the second set of hearings were pending, I didn't even get to see him face to face. It was through a video screen. And now that he's in prison, it's even worse, especially through COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that, from a systems perspective, do not make sense. How do these kids grow, thrive, survive if they're not, especially, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just so many things wrong with the system. And that's what I looked at. And then, you know, and then of course the way they dealt with him immediately after what happened was horrible. And so the juvenile system, the way we evaluate students in terms of MRIs, and that's the other aspect of it, is I was a systems engineer on MRI. I was building MRI systems.
Oh, wow.
And so I know about how MRI systems and the progress that we've made with understanding the brain based on these MRIs. And this is back in the 90s, but we started using systems to analyze the brain in the 80s. And here we are in 2024 now. We still don't respect the work that they found in terms of abnormalities in brain based on trauma, lack of sleep, lack of food, etc.
It sounds dire, right? It sounds like there's a lot broken in the system. Are there any? Have you seen any success stories or positive outcomes from your work having a significant impact on young people and their families who are in the system?
Well, specifically with that is we've got a backlog of people that have served at least the 15 years, and so two of my good friends, one whose husband served 27 years, and she met him and courted him while he was in jail, but it was 27 years, and he's out now, and he was not even the original offender, it was somebody else, but he happened to be at the scene. I forget which charge that was. And then another young lady who went through this second chance with law and is now out. And so she's living with her mother. She had gone through and gotten herself a bachelor's degree while she was in prison. And so these are model children, or, now adults, that are ready to contribute to society and are ready to be with their families. And that's, to me, a huge success story. When you sell humans, just put it in place, there's just no hope. I mean, if somebody's given life, they don't have anything to try for, And so that's what that Second Chances Bill is about, and that is a success story. On the gun side of things, which contributes to helping children, we passed the Child Access Law, which can be used to hold a parent responsible if the child either brandishes a weapon, like goes to school with a weapon, and just starts pulling it out and threatening, or it's a fourth degree felony if a child uses that and for bodily harm. So the parents need to be, or the gun owner needs to be more responsible about locking up their firearm in order not to be potentially charged under this law.
Here's just a little bit of context for what we're dealing with here in Alaska. Alaska typically ranks higher than the national average when it comes to juvenile arrests and detaining juveniles when they're convicted of a crime, both violent and property crimes. And according to the National Center for Juvenile Justice, Alaska has nearly double the number of detained youth than every other state per capita. So how can communities and individuals in Alaska get involved or help support these kinds of advocacy efforts in order to improve juvenile justice?
Well, the kind of advocacy that I would go for is to advocate that these children are actually treated as children from the day that they commit whatever crime that they commit. And that would include, here in New Mexico, we have what we call CASA, court-appointed special advocate, and you can become a court-appointed special advocate. My husband was, and by going through a set of courses, and you actually are to visit a home, and see how that home is functioning, and in the case of children, you can advocate for particular outcomes for a child based on any kind of activity that they're involved with, that may be criminal or delinquent in some way. So there's a lot of avenues to both insert yourself into the system through through a judge advocate. Basically, you become a helper for the judge in terms of deciding what's going to happen with these children. But there's also these kinds of things that I did, which is to advocate for more services while the child is still a child, till they're 25. And those usually are legislative budget items, mm-hmm. and usually can come under particular laws, but you can amend the laws for budget purposes as well. Those are kind of things that I think of when I'm thinking of how do I get involved.
And what organizations would you recommend for listeners who want to learn more about juvenile justice and like you said, get involved? You mentioned the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. Is that a nationwide?
Yes, it's a national organization, and they have, and those are the ones that I, 80% of my royalties from a book go to Everytown for Gun Safety and Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, 40% each. And the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth offers, you know, model legislation. They'll offer, lawyers that can go through whatever legislation you're trying to get through. They offer people that will come and talk to the legislators. That's what they did with us to get our Second Chances Bill. So definitely a Second Chances Bill for children at the minimum is necessary. Now they're working on second chances even for adult offenders, but the one that I'm most interested in is the ones for juveniles. The other thing that you can do is FAM, which is Families Against Mandatory Minimum, FAMM, or Mandatory Minimum, yeah. So that influences the sentencing, the length of sentences that children could potentially get based on certain crimes and how they are exactly sentenced. Because there's a lot of latitude that judges have based on legislation around sentencing. So a child could be sentenced to some sort of work option and some sentence for some time. Some limitations or conditions on probation. There's a lot of way of sentencing, and that's one of the things that if you have, especially if you have a child that is in the system, mm-hmm. that you should check out how the sentencing is done.
Well, we have about 15 seconds left. So is there one final message or call to action you'd like to convey to our listeners regarding the importance of supporting juvenile justice reform and advocacy?
I would say life is really tough for a lot of families now, especially families that struggle, single parent families, and we should not be throwing our children away. We as adults are responsible for these children, and there's something that's going terribly wrong when you have that many children in the system.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Regina Griego. Regina, thanks so much for joining us. Her book is Sins of the System, Trauma, Guns, Tragedy, and the Betrayal of Our Children. You can check out her website, transcendingfutures.com. Regina, thank you for talking with us today, and thank you for your advocacy.
Thank you, Jared. Okay. Good luck there in Alaska.
Thanks so much. And thanks to our listeners for listening to Talk of the Rock.